Welcome to the newest episode of Walnut Grovecast. Walnut Grovecast needs your support, so please head over to patreon.com/walnutgrovecast to find out what cool stuff you get for as little as 17 cents a day. Yes, only 17 cents a day gets you some amazing stuff. Thank you so much for your support. Grovecast. My name is Mark. Today's guest has been on many of the most popular television shows, such as The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, The Waltons, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy, Chips, and also in films such as Adventures in Babysitting, Hiding Out, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter is Dead, and of course, if you're listening to the show, you may remember him as Timothy from the Little House on the Prairie episode, Make a Joyful Noise. Please welcome to the show, Keith Coogan. How are you, Keith?
I am amazing. Thank you. And I'm credited as Keith Mitchell in the Little House episode. Thanks for having me on the show. I was so, so awesome to be on, Little House. I mean, it's a legendary show.
I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. I really do. And, I know that you only were on one episode, but I definitely think you made an impact in the Little House universe, which, believe it or not, is a universe.
I totally believe in the Nutverse, in the Walnut Groveverse. Funny, I grew up in a little bit in Sacramento when I was really young, like maybe 3 or 4 years old, about the time that the impetus to act, the bug bit me. Mm-hmm. And Walnut Grove's up there in central something, California, right?
Yeah.
Physically. and I grew up in, and then we moved down to LA and started acting and stuff. And one of my neighbors in Malibu were twins, Rachel and Robin Bush.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
They just happened to be Lindsay and Sydney Greenbush, if they're stage names. And they played Carrie. And no, she was not tripped. She really tripped down the hill.
I spoke to her, actually.
Do they string a cable and try to trip you? And you go, lucky
BB gun. it'd be really cute, make one fall.
Oh my god.
That's really funny. It's like a small world. Hollywood really is a tiny little universe.
It is. I never left Burbank when we shot our episode.
Oh really?
I think they shot it, was it Warner Brothers back lot? Can't remember where it was. I think it might have been Warner Brothers backlot at the time. It was the same square that they used for Dukes of Hazzard, and the Waltons also used it, and that's where the schoolhouse for Little House was.
Yeah, it's crazy, too, because, by 81, the show had already really been on the air.
It's made its mark. That's right. It was a Laramie Street Warner Brothers backlot, but it was like a one long street at the end, had like kind of a bank building off the side, but they put the school for the blind, and it's the only time I've ever played blind. So I had like, it was a real steep learning curve, all these tricks to like play blind, and very hard. To be on both Waltons, and I was on that for a while, a year. I did 18 episodes of the Waltons, and then tap over into a Little House was definitely a nice addition to the old resume.
Yeah, and it seems
the episode
normal.
Is interesting. It focuses on just the blind school, and has the this almost wedding at the end until I come in singing "Go Tell It on the Mountain." So if you hear "Go Tell It on the Mountain" back, you're like, "Oh, that's that episode, season 2, episode 15." Great.
It's a big role. I mean. And you were about 10 or 11 years old there.
We shot it the day after the day they shot John Lennon, because I was on
Wow.
Laverne and Shirley, and our filming night was Tuesday nights, the same night that Laverne and Shirley aired. And it was the day that they shot John Lennon, and they were going to take down the cardboard cutouts. It was after the Laverne and Shirley had moved to LA. And they were going to take down the cardboard cutouts in front of the audience. They're like right there on the stairs on their set, which is basically the 2.5 man set. Anyway, and they said, well, it doesn't matter. The episode's going to air tonight, and it's going to have the cardboard cutout in the opening credits. So audiences are going to see it tonight, and then this airs in 4 or 5 weeks. So it's not going to make sense. It doesn't have it. Why did they wait 3 weeks? And so they left it in. And I remember there's a SAG rule that you can't work until you've been wrapped for 12 hours. So if you work till 10 o'clock at night, they have to wait till 10 o'clock in the morning to bring you into work. But it was two different shows. So I left the taping of Laverne and Shirley at like 11 o'clock at night, and then went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning on Little House on the Prairie the next day.
Holy
So I
crap.
think it was December 10th that we started filming. Or either 9th or 10th that we started shooting that episode.
Wow. I mean, and
That aired in January.
it's such a big
It aired like four or
event,
five weeks after we shot it.
I mean, when Lennon was assassinated, when he it must have made such an impact on you being, even being young though, for this to have affected the
I've never
day, you know?
associated with I've never even associated these two jobs until my mom reminded me that we'd left one set and then went to the next one the next morning.
Wow.
And because I was connected to the John Lennon shooting with Laverne and Shirley for me, but the episode we were shooting for Little House on the Prairie is pretty somber. And, it's a blind school. These kids lived through, God, whatever disease or wagon accident they had that made them blind.
Yeah.
I think literally my character had a wagon accident instead of like rubella or whatever the heck everyone else was getting.
The kid became lame.
So it was like already, not a fun set, at least for my episode. It
Yeah,
was pretty,
no,
we were
it's
doing a little melodrama. We were
yeah.
shooting, but also Little House could be very fun and very family and very funny. This episode wasn't.
Yeah, this was like a
And I'm a
tragic one.
I was this little ringer they'd bring in. They go, all right, it's a pretty good guest role. It's like five scenes, eight scenes, whatever it is. And he's like, okay, I'd learn my lines. And I'd go on the set, dress up in whatever period clothing they needed me to dress up. All my characters and all of my TV as a kid had a last syllable of their first name ending in E. So Timmy, Stevie, Jeffrey, Bobby. Stevie cracked me up. I'm like, not just Steve, but Stevie. So what am I in this one? Timothy? Which was also my name on the Waltons was, no, that was Jeffrey. Never mind. I get all confused.
Yeah, I was just looking.
There's just like these kid roles they give you. And this is a cool one. And I had to like cry. And
Yeah, eight is enough. You're a Bobby.
Bobby. Yes. Bobby, I'm
Fantasy
only
Island,
mad.
you became Scooter, so that's all right.
Scooter.
But
Oh my
between
God, that's right. I got to
79,
work with Bob Denver on that one. Eagle Man.
oh, really? That's actually really, I mean, I always liked Bob Denver.
Single dad, and the kid doesn't listen to him or pay attention. He's just got his head buried in Eagle Man comic books. So the dad's fantasy is to become Eagle Man. So they build an eagle cave and a whole suit, and they even arrange for like petty theft to happen around him and his kid near the pool so that his dad can turn into Eagle Man and like rescue people in front of his son. It was a weird episode.
Now, between 79 and say 83, it seems as though you were just constantly working. Do you remember this period of time in your life where it was just like, I mean, it must have been pretty exciting, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you go to public school mostly, and then after school you go and you run on these auditions. And I booked a lot. I definitely got in with good producers, like Spelling, so you wind up on all of the Aaron Spelling shows.
Gotta love that,
Yeah, and I had a little nickname, One Take Mitchell. And
gotta love that too.
I think it was because I wasn't a really good actor, and they decided no matter how many takes they did, the first take was fine. Mm-hmm. And I never stumbled my lines, never, you know, wasted time on a set, just rolling.
Just nail it. Well, that's awesome.
And it was, you know, doing, paying your dues. Back then, it was to get to the movie career, you had to go through, you know, do commercials first and then mm-hmm. guest appearances on shows. I wound up doing 4 episodes of Chips. Two is 2 different characters, and then the 3rd and 4th one, they were trying to spin off Chips, so we were the Bat Patrol. So I did 2 episodes, one of the same thing. It was fun. It was fun running around doing shows. There was a lot of car stuff, car stunts, horses, mm-hmm. both in Little House, had horses, and I did a series, the Apple Dumpling Gang series for Disney. That Adam Rich and I actually traded roles. I did the pilot. He did the first 2 episodes. Then I did the last 4 episodes. Then they flipped him and aired mine first, and then aired his. Like, it was such a mess.
No, did you watch any TV?
It is enough. Yes, you watch it. We got one of those, like, at the time, like $600 was a lot to spend on a video cassette recorder at home.
Yeah.
But we had like this wood deck, you know, thing that was the most expensive piece of equipment in our house. And my mom would dutifully tape everything that I was on.
Wow. I mean, but I'm wondering, were you a fan of television? Like, were there shows? So you still had time to watch TV. Yeah. You know, it's wild.
Yeah, there's a little after dinner. You're allowed prime time. Mm-hmm. Probably send the kids to bed, you know, by 10.
Yeah.
My parents did let me watch Saturday Night Live, though, which I thought was they scary. You could stay up until Mr. Bill, and then you got to go to bed. Yeah, I watched definitely watch TV because it's your job, it's your occupation, it's what you do. So you got to see what the current trends are. You got to see what the acting styles are. You got to see who your competition is and watch stuff that you don't even get. You got to watch it to see who got cast and why they got cast in it.
Hmm. Did you at this point find roles that you really kind of wanted? And maybe they went to either a friend or somebody you knew, or vice versa. Maybe you got the role and it was from somebody who was trying to get in there. Like, were there ever any type of things like that would come up?
Tough to say when there isn't, because you're really auditioning for everything.
Right.
So, you know, by 8, I think I'd really set my mind on being in movies. And so I was auditioning for, you know, everything I could, E.T. and Goonies and Gremlins. And, you get the movies that you're right for.
Mm-hmm.
If you're very, very lucky, of course, there's so much luck involved. And, I was at an autograph convention. Will Wheaton was also there, and I've worked with Will 3 times now. So we have kind of practical joke relationship. We're always just pulling crap on each other. And Will comes over and he's looking at the pictures on my table and he looks at Adventures of Babysitting and he's like, that one. I'm like, what? I think it's that movie. I wish I was in that movie. And I'm like, you've got Stand By Me. You've got freaking, come on, that's ridiculous. He goes, would you trade? And I said, no. And he goes, well, there you go.
And we were also, you know, you have a similar career. From my point of view, as your grandfather, and that's Jackie Coogan. I was just saying before we started recording how he's one of these people who I consider kind of Hollywood royalty, because he his career started out as the child in Charlie Chaplin's The Kid in 1921. Which, of course, is, you know, who doesn't love this film? He went on to, you know, had a varied career and worked throughout his entire life. But he started out in a, you know, very young as well. And I'm wondering, is this like in your DNA? Like, is this something that at an early age you were thinking, like, you know, well, you know, it, you know, you looked up to him, of course. And, you know, you kind of want to do what he might have done.
I think it's both. In this case, you've got
it's a very personal question, of
my
course.
My great grandparents were in vaudeville, mm-hmm. and had my grandfather was basically born, you know, in a trunk on vaudeville circuit, and so was already, you know, I think he did a short Skinner's baby at like 1.5 years old. It was his first screen appearance. And he's working. He's in the vaudeville troupe. And, of course, the family's very savvy. They had extra money for it because a new member has joined the act. And so by 4 years old, he was closing the show with a speech from, like, Inherit the Wind. And that was the night the chaplain had come down to the Orpheum because they said, you got to go see Coogan's act. And that meant Jack Coogan, my great-grandfather, who was an eccentric dancer. He would have these very flexible, and there's actually YouTube videos with, my great-grandfather was in films with Fatty Arbuckle and Buster Keaton.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and there's two online, Hayseed and Backstage. And in both of them, one of them he shows his kind of acrobatic dancing skills, and the other he just plays a kind of, you know, cliched bad guy with the twisty mustache and everything. He's very tall and thin and gangly, but apparently had created this kind of vaudeville act around this weird dancing. And my great-grandmother, Lillian, was part of a twofer, like a sister act. In vaudeville, you have the first act, and then you have two people come out in front of the curtain while you're setting up the third act, which is like the dogs or the spinning plates behind. And so the second spot in a vaudeville show is called the two spot. And so either two comedians or two sisters, quote unquote, the girl who was her sister wasn't really her sister. They'd sing a duet or something and then, you know, set up the stage behind. So they'd met on the road. And when my grandfather came out to close the show, Chaplin went nuts, wanted to talk to him. And in the Chaplin movie, he found out next morning that, oh, Jackie Coogan's been signed. It was the father who was signed to Gene Chance, and the kid was still available. So my grandfather had been kind of seasoned on stage and learned bits and stick and could imitate and mimic anybody and knew a lot of the bits and was already jaded at four. And it was a kind of, you know, Chaplin just wanted to work with someone who could recreate bits and try to keep a straight face.
No.
And then I had skipped. My grandfather and my mom had weren't getting along because she was a 15-year-old pregnant runaway.
Wow.
Very anti-brand for Little House on the Prairie.
That might be an episode. I'm not really sure.
By the time, exactly. By the time that they'd reconnected, I'd already started acting. So in Sacramento, at about 4 years old, the same age as my grandfather. So my grandfather started shaving the kid in 1919. And it took a year and a day to make. And then it was released in 21.
And this is all in California?
This is all at Chaplin's new studio, Chaplin Studios, and at the old Chinatown, which is where our Union Station sits in Los Angeles now.
Oh, okay.
And they shot all over. There's a lot of different places they shot in L.A. And there's a lot of breakdowns of the various locations that they've used.
It's a fascinating story.
I don't know what version of the kid you see, because there's an original version as screened. It's a little longer than the one we're used to seeing now. Chaplin recut it and put a music score on it in like 1971, re-upping the copyright, but only for the new version. And the old version has extra additional scenes with the mom and some other side stories. So you can play the old version. It's copyright free, but then the new version. He's very smart.
I have a Laserdisc box set because that's where I was spending my money in the 90s. I've some mutual box set of Chaplin's remastered
very
some things.
Good. That's got the Rink.
Yes.
The Floorwalker. Good collection.
Yeah, but I don't think the kid is in that one. I do have a version of the kid, which is the full version that you're talking about. I don't, but you know, it's really just, I'm such a fan of these films. You know, beautifully, they were kept beautiful. Chaplin had the foresight to keep these, you know, the negatives clean and preserved. not all of them. The early stuff, of course, looks terrible.
Great webpage on the locations that Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and Charlie Chaplin used. And they found out between Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton, about 30% of the locations they use are still exist today.
Oh, really?
With Charlie Chaplin, they found out that 90% of the locations he used still exist today.
You gotta love that.
How do you account for that discrepancy? How is it? Did he use more iconic buildings that lasted, or did by being in Chaplin films they've lasted? it's too far off and divergent of a percentage. But the Chaplin was inspired by Keaton on the set for The Kid, that T-shaped kind of alley set. Was he really liked a set that Keaton had just a few blocks away down in Hollywood East over actually about a mile east or so is where Keaton's and I think Chaplin even borrowed Keaton's set to do A Dog's Life, which was the precursor to The Kid. It was basically the same story, but with a dog.
Now, have you had the, do you own any artifacts from that period of time? Like, do you have it seems though you're very knowledgeable on the subject. And I would imagine that if possible, you would own artifacts from that era. I'm just not
sure. So the family hung on to, like, so part of the reason why the Jackie Coogan, the Coogan act, is he'd made money doing films, yes, but a lot of the money came from merchandising. My grandfather was one of the first and heavily merchandised stars with sheet music and haircuts and dolls and hood ornaments and pencil tins and peanut brittle. So we tried to keep, you know, what size Jackie Coogan doll do you keep? We'd had one that was 3 inches and 5 and the 9 inch and the 13 inch and that, you know, going up to a 2 to 3 foot statue you put by your fireplace.
Wow.
So we tried to keep kind of one, a sample of everything, and hold on to that kind of stuff. But there was so much of it that it's pretty easy to find it on eBay, actually. Look at Jackie Coogan and you'll see an amazing amount of bubblegum cards and all that kind of stuff.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it's definitely, it's eye-opening because it's so early in that entire industry that was really kind of become, you know, multiple billions of dollars worth of sales every year, you know, just the promotion of an artist. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's when you luck out and like me doing all that kind of 70s TV, there's a machine involved there. And when you luck out to be latch on and be part of that machine, learn your lines, show up on time, don't get in fights with anybody, and you'll work. So we're going to skip the generation because I didn't know my grandfather was in the business or who he was or what, and I wanted to be on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom was like, ah, crap. It's in the blood. It's got to be in the blood.
Well, I remember, so, I mean, you were in a number of film, of TV shows throughout the 70s, but also into the 80s. And I remember in particular the movie Hiding Out, which as a kid, I loved this movie. I'm not really sure. And I watched it not that long ago and I still felt as though it held up. It's a really fun movie where you co-starred with John Cryer, I'm not sure what John Cryer's up to. I know he had a TV show for a while. It's been kind of quiet lately, which, you know what, there's nothing wrong with being quiet either. But I remember that particular thing, and I remember your role so much, and I remember thinking, where do I know this guy from, even as a kid? And then I started kind of seeing, you know, backwards. I kind of would see a rerun of Silver Spoons, and you'd be on it. And I started, like, kind of identifying this, like, reverse trait, and then I remember Little House on the Prairie one day, and I'm like, that's what? You know, it's like traveling back in time. And that's why I was like, you know, you were also in I'm sorry, all of a sudden, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter is Dead, which was completely hilarious, and Adventures in Babysitting. So, you know, these movies, you were kind of recreating yourself also, I think, in the late 80s, because you were kind of becoming the rock kid. I always thought of you as, like, the friend we all had with, like, long hair who's, like, I don't know, the rock kid, you know? That's just kind of the what I kind of thought of you as.
And well,
I think it's a good thing.
You know, total fabrication. It was a nice wig and great costumes and amazing writing. And it's far from, you know, the nerd that I really am. Anything he's getting down his nerd track and play the nerd in this and this and this and the best friend of the brother. And so I really like being the stoner brother guy that redeems himself.
I learned that you have a background in coding and Java, and which really kind of I was like, oh wait, hold on, because I do Objective-C coding. You know,
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, don't capitalize until you get to the second word. You know, it's Objective-C is so, I don't know. I like it. It's one of those kind of ecosystems that I've learned to live in.
I like it when you can do elegant things with a brutal system. And I like it that they're one step away from machine code. And that's I think, the power of, like, programming and stuff.
I feel like I can travel back in time and work on the computers, maybe, if I can figure a way to use the terminal.
Yeah, legacy code. They got spaghettiing through all of these systems.
It's true.
How old is the Swift software? Oh, my God. The, 14 years old or something. Like that. Oh, my God.
But, you know, I do some of that stuff. But Java is one of those things where I tried to embrace it, and there's something about it that I just couldn't get into. I don't know. I think you have to have the mind of somebody who's really good at chess to really develop in Java. And I'm not
my
really like that.
My grandfather taught me how to play chess.
There you go.
And I was 14 when he finally passed away in 1984. And by the time I was 8 or 9, my mom had reconnected with my grandfather. They were spending summers with us out at the beach because they'd lived in Palm Springs. It'd get way too hot in the summers there. So I always spent 3-4 months a year with my grandparents. He taught me how to, like, trip hammer people and jackhammer them. And I finally was beating him one game after dozens of matches. And, he got up to go get some more iced tea, and his knee hit the chessboard. And, you know, pieces go flying. And, we'll play another game. I guess, okay, I remember where everything was. I started to be able to get up there and beat
him.
That's
pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Object-oriented programming is weird. It's counterintuitive. I never really got into recursion. And so, it was fun. And now I love databases. I love, fascinated with databases.
So you're a secret geek, maybe not so secret to the people who know you.
Yeah.
but that's always a good thing to have. I feel as though that means you know how to use your phone. You know how to not freak out because your computer's not booting up correctly, or how to swap out a video card. And, you know, it's important
things
to know. I got my
first computer, 1986. I got an Apple IIc.
Nice.
The portable one, you know, with a 13-pound CRT monitor. And
quote-unquote portable.
You know, it was portable. Hey, it could play one-on-one with Larry Bird. That's all that really mattered.
You have a polyphonic synthesizer, probably.
Oh, sure.
That's awesome, man. That's the Tron soundtrack right there.
it was awesome. And they had Apple IIe's at school, a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I first semester took the computer science class because they just installed these, like, 8, you know, computers. And then second semester, I was the TA.
That's awesome.
We paid Taipei, and you know, the trading game with the ships trading, like, opium and spice and silk throughout the trading in ports and stuff like that. And during the battle scenes, people were just letting the cycle play, and I realized if you hold space down, it cycled through the animation much faster, and you get more stops in.
Oh, really?
So I just sat there and hold it while it's going, and I'm getting them on 6, 17 battles, and then people are on their first or second battle. So I won quite handily with like $1.3 million at the end of the period.
You found one glitch and you took advantage of it.
It was a feature.
Exactly. Do you collect anything from that era? I mean, any old computers or anything like that?
I got my first iPhone. And second and third. I got, I think the current version of my Mac goes back to 2001, maybe.
Oh,
like
okay.
The part of it kind of keep going and just migrating from different systems,
Yeah, I buy up old computers.
PC, I had a Frankenstein AMD that was, I would overclock and it would run so hot, I just left it open. So it looked like the Gorgon monster or whatever the heck you call it from Upside Down.
Yeah, I mean, it's always cool to do that too, you know.
I called it Frankenstein and I had a circular fan, you know, above overhead fan. It was fine. It worked great.
Fry an egg on that processor.
But there was a gap where I didn't have. Oh, I did. I ran Cakewalk. I had like a music studio, and Cakewalk was like a MIDI sequencer.
No, I know Cakewalk tracks. Well. Yeah.
I had my stepdad was kind of a computer nerd, and set up a front end menu for Windows 3.0, which I thought was really cool.
Oh, really?
So I had like. It wasn't really graphical, but it was kind of and I learned how to get in there and kind of hack it and add programs and remove them. So you just hit, you know, the number of you want. Like a menu would come up when you boot, and you just pick what program you want to run. Like number 3, Cakewalk. Thank you very much.
And you jump on Prodigy and find some friends.
Oh, my God. I think I did Mindspring.
I remember Mindspring.
For a while.
It's like only $9.95 a month for.
I just skipped. The only thing is I skipped from when the internet just kind of started. I skipped the whole AOL years. I just wasn't really online or anything. I didn't understand that. I had a Sega 32X. I was good. I even fell for the Saturn. So I was like Sega 8-bit Master System, Sega, you know, Genesis, the whole deal. Hundreds of games. I totaled it up, so I wound up handing every single game and everything to my little brother. I had the steering wheels and the pads and the head VR and everything.
Yeah, I love it all.
Over $6,000 on cartridge-based games and consoles. Ugh. That was collected over like a decade.
So this is what you were doing in between working, essentially.
Yeah, well, I was working, and so I wasn't really around it. So then I sat back down at the computer in like 99 maybe and saw what had happened with the Wide Web. I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then learned how to HTML in like 2 days.
Yeah.
And then on the side would build websites for friends.
That's awesome though. I mean, I love the fact that, you know, it's something you're passionate about, you know, and it really goes back to when you were a kid. Because you were a geek as a kid, so.
I was also a music nerd, so, like, that was another language, being able to read sheet music. I was definitely very literate. I started reading at, like, 3, big nerd. Huge, uber nerd. But I was always trying to look cool. Right. I was trying to, like, be a tough guy and listen to Nirvana. Yeah, I got a pit bull. And it just really fit me. I'm a big nerd.
So, are you a musician?
I do play. Well, every character you play, you kind of take something because you did research on it. So, like in Cousins, I walked away with a video camera and started videotaping everything after that. And Don't Tell Mom, I picked up guitar and started playing guitar after I shot that.
I think that's great. I mean, I play
and
guitar.
Cooking.
Oh, and cooking. I remember you have a scene in there cooking.
And cooking.
But you know, it seems like you've just been on a constant flow of, you know, you don't really vanish for very long. You know, you're constantly to be working on a project. I mean, your resume is very long. I mean, I'd say, the only other person in Little House with a resume as long is probably, Lucy Lee Flippin, who played Mrs. Wild or Ms. Wilder. And she was just
I think
many.
Melissa Gilbert's is a little longer, but we'll, you know.
Yeah, you know, I guess maybe. Yeah. All right, out of the people I've
maybe.
Spoken to.
I don't know. Well, and then you talk about a force like Michael Landon and
right.
Producing and writing and directing, and that's starring in a show.
That's true. I didn't count all that.
Yeah. I've shot movies at Lacey's studio, at Landon Studios in Santa Clarita.
Oh.
He had built a movie studio, and I've shot movies in those sound stages. What are they called? They're named after one of his kids.
I know there's Michael Landon Jr. I don't know the other kids. But so
I do have to note one bit of trivia on Make a Joyful Noise. 'Twas not I making that joyful noise.
You know, that was my question when you said when you hear me singing it, I'm like, I kind of thought, okay, is that you singing it? I kind of was just going to leave that alone, but you're saying it's not.
Oh, no, I lip sync. They had some kid come in that was like 13 years old, recorded it, and I just
was he blind?
God, I don't know. No. Oh, God. The blind was the hardest thing. They're like, just pick a spot just up into the left of people and stare at that. I'm like, oh, God, this is so hard. I couldn't do it because I was a big mugging actor. I didn't need to use my eyes. And mm-hmm. Couldn't do it for that. So it was pretty serious undertaking to do Little House.
Another thing that you've worked on, you worked with Disney in The Fox and the Hound and doing voice work. How do you enjoy doing voice work?
It's the only voice work I've done.
Oh, really? Well, what do you think of it, though? I mean, is it something, you know, working with Disney on something like that? You know,
recently, I auditioned for hundreds of things,
mm-hmm.
Including the new voice of Jack at Jack in the Box. Try our new Tasty Jack value menu. Just, you know, nothing. It's very hard. It's very competitive. It's very insular. It's hard to kind of crack that and get in there. I don't know how I got it. There must have been auditions. I must have been yelling and screaming at the playground. And my voice had that raspy kind of, you know, Fox voice.
Mm-hmm.
And did it. It took years. We started in 79.
Mm-hmm.
Working on it and doing voices. And 79, 80, Don Bluth left the production, stalled the release, and it came out finally in 81.
So you were in and out constantly to just record voice?
Yeah, they wanted me, and you know who the Hound was, right?
No.
Corey Feldman.
Oh, really? I know that you also worked on the Tell the Two Corys.
Yes. Oh, my God, that was so crazy. So for Fox and the Hound, we would come in and do our first couple of scenes, and they go, great, go home. And they'd take a couple of months, and they'd animate that stuff up, and then they'd bring us back in. And they wanted our voices to kind of mature as we were going.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh. No, I didn't know that he was also involved in that. That's, you know, another person who, you know, seems to have such a varied career, and... just, I don't know. It just seems like, you know, you can just flip on TV. And I think that I wouldn't be so surprised if you popped up on something. That's all. And the same thing with kind of him.
Appreciate that.
No, I like that. There's a certain comfortability.
Dead because HBO was one of the producers of it. So it's always on HBO and summertime. They'll play it. It's a summer picture. And I understand Delta Mama Babysitter's Dead has a beautiful following in Australia. And we were talking to some friends from Australia that said, well, in U.S. pictures, they don't really talk about or mention Australia much. So anytime in a movie, they talk about Australia, they just love it. So since the mom goes running off for a sheep herder in Australia for a few months, abandoning the kids at home, apparently it's this big deal.
Now, you said working on Tale of Two Corys was kind of crazy.
Oh, yeah, because here you are wearing clothes that were vintage, that had been there. You're shooting on locations and you're, you know, recreating sets of places that you were. I didn't play myself, but it was just really eerie because I'm in a scene going, I wonder where I was while this was happening.
Buying a computer.
Exactly.
But, you know, I've always been fascinated by the two Coreys and, you know, the work that they've done, that they did, you know, with, like, Lost Boys.
Me too. Totally.
I even watched that TV show, The Two Coreys. I don't know.
It was a zeitgeist. It was a phenomenon. It's like a Hope and Crosby, swear to God, for, you know, teenage audiences to have these two kids that, you know, have incredible charisma together, are both very talented, have their own careers outside of The Two Coreys. It was a lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, of course, tragically, you know, I think it was, I don't even know how many years ago now, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, where Corey Feldman passed away. And, you know, that it's...
Feldman's...
I'm sorry. Oh, geez. I always... See, it's two Coreys. I have to always confuse that. Corey Haim, of course, passed away. But, yeah, I watched that show that they would... you know, kind of do. And I'm thinking, all right, you know what? If they have this show, maybe they're kind of like going to clean up, you know, Haim's act, and he's going to, you know, straighten out. And it just, you know, spiraled out of control. You know, it seems as though sometimes I think Hollywood will do that to people. It seems as though you somehow avoided, of course, thankfully, this, you know, getting pulled too far into, you know, the corner of evil, I guess. And, do you look back and you're like, wow, you know, that could have been a messy situation if I'd gone to this particular party, or cause I'm, you know, I spent a little bit of time out in LA, and I, as a New Yorker, I couldn't keep up with them. You know, it was just, there's something about you guys.
New Yorkers go all night.
But you guys have all the energy in the world. We want to take naps.
We don't have energy. Dude, we're so lazy. If our car is parked too far away, we get a ride to our car.
It's kind of true. But yeah, you need a car, though. You get used to needing
What's
a car.
The saying? They shook the United States. They leaned it to the left. And everything that was loose ruled to California.
You know, I got a little bit of street cred just because I would say, I'm from New York. And it's like, immediately they think you're kind of tough. They don't realize that you just grew up on the South Shore of Long Island. And there's really no reason to be afraid of me on any level.
Where's your hood? Montauk. That really isn't that tough, buddy.
I grew up on the beaches of Montauk. I used to say I crawled out of the sewers of Cedarhurst, and that's where I grew up. And it's
crawled
like,
out of the sewers of Cedarhurst, yo, for life.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know what? We only had... two synagogues that were nearby that I could walk to. Only two. That's how tough it was. But now we have four, thankfully. So looking back on all of this, I, you know, because I'd say that there are a lot of people who are that are part of your generation, my generation too, are about the same age. And, you know, maybe they're even, they just started. Like maybe their career's only been 10 years old or something. Your career goes your whole life almost. When you look back at stuff like the 70s and, you know, all of this stuff that you did, how do you feel about it? I mean, there's kind of, do you see the coolness factor of being on some hit shows from the 70s, hit shows from the 80s and movies?
No, of course. I mean, I would like
to. Do you appreciate it and love it? I mean, it's
a businessman that pins the first dollar they made up on the wall and keeps it behind the register.
Right.
I am super proud of all of the TV. You know, it always stuns me when people will pick, you know, some credits for an intro or something like that.
Right.
And I'll be listening along and then they'll say, you know, and the Knight Rider, and then Super Train. I'm like, that's right, I did Super Train.
And Knight Rider, I mean, that alone, come on.
That was, you know, that was the when you asked if, you know, I watched the shows, Knight Rider is a perfect example of a show. I was super excited. I knew it was going to be on. It was in all of the, you know, special effects magazines and like sci-fi stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in episode 3, which means I shot it before any Knight Rider was ever on the air. So I got to sit and kit with, you know, David and Michael and the whole deal. We shot it in Clock Tower Square on Universal Studios.
Wow.
The bait shop in that was the same location where the Cafe 50s diner was, and also the diner from The Sting, where the phone calls were made.
You must remember that Knight Rider had so much of a push. Like, it was a hit before it aired. And I just remember it. It was going to be, for my age group, it was the only real show that you really should be watching that night. it was a very important show.
Larson knew what he was doing. Yeah. He ripped the Cylon out of, ripped the dang light out of a Cylon's head, stuck it in the front grill between them, and called it lunch. They just knew, man. They knew. They nailed it. That show went and retooled and did different things it had to do to stay alive. And ultimately, it's bad when you have the twins. You know, that's, you know, when there was Connor.
Yeah.
And the other evil Michael Knight. No, that's when you know the show's jumped the shark.
The Knight automated roving robot.
And that's one of those, not regrets, but happy days. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did a Laverne and Shirley. And I always be like, yeah, but it's a later Laverne's, really, after they moved to L.A. And it's just very close. It's pretty close that you could get to Happy Days. I did It's a Living with Ann Gillian for Criminy. But
I forgot about that show. I remember It's a Living. I remember, yeah.
I did read for Happy Days. I didn't get it. And I was always upset to never have been on. And Cheers. I read for Cheers and never got on Cheers.
Wow. Yeah, you really did touch upon so much. And even what you're saying, you know, Laverne and Shirley, you did get into the ecosystem of it. You know, it is connected. You know, that's really amazing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Fantasy Island, come on. How can you not?
Oh, my God.
Those
are definitely the two fun. Fantasy Island, Love Boat, big, big.
Yeah.
Love Boat was the only job as a kid that I was ever offered. I did not have to audition for Love Boat.
Oh, really? The Love Boat,
so they just take whatever your Q rating is at the time, and I was just on so much stuff at the time. They're like, yeah, grab that kid.
Mm-hmm. I just feel like the Love Boat should come back. It just seems like the perfect kind of show to just bring celebrities together and, you know, and start careers and have a middle spot.
I think
spot.
Little House should come back, because I had always thought that the Waltons could be done now very easily with families, you know, economy tough and people moving back home. And
sure.
All of a sudden, the grandparents found they've got, you know, two generations living under them in the house and 12 kids here, and it's the Waltons all over again.
Yeah.
Little House, I think, needs to be on the prairie. I think it needs to be of that time. And I know that Laura Ingalls was getting recent, like, why didn't you bring this up when I was going to school, recent criticisms of talking about how people felt at the time of the other races out and about in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, well, this is something of its time. Go read The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County and talk to me later.
Yeah, a lot of stuff I read as a kid was, I guess, let's just say racially insensitive when compared to today's standards, or even when I was a kid standards. Richard Wright's Black Boy, for instance. I think I read this in third grade. It gave me my first real indication, a real kind of inciting view of what it was like to grow up as a black child in the South. And it didn't even touch upon it, but it was just how poor they were and how tough it really was. And I don't know, I grew up fine. I grew up with an appreciation of the writing. You know, it's, we can't, I'm very against censoring and getting rid of books. And
oh,
the writing, the
my favorite book was Mutiny on the Bounty by William H. Bly. Mm-hmm. And there's some passages in there with the native girls. And I don't even want to get into it. An 8-year-old shouldn't be reading this stuff. But
right.
It's in the library at school. So I dug it. I dug it. I don't believe in censorship either. And I do support reading as fundamental. I think that it's important that kids start reading early and often, start writing and reading. It's the greatest way to pass on our life experience to the next generations is literature.
I always ask people.
Now we got
though,
memes and we got you know, Vines. That's
that's it. We don't. I mean, my 10-year-old kid. We just bought him a new iPhone, right? I mean, it's a necessary evil these days. But you know, I want my kid, and thankfully he does read. I want him reading more than a text from his friends that, you know, are 90% misspelled. or abbreviated. I really find the written word very important. I find these things to be dying out, and I don't know, just personally, I really push reading, and thankfully I'm blessed enough where he actually does appreciate reading physical, tangible books. But I always ask people, in your situation as an actor, what was your first car? I have to ask.
Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme Brougham with T-tops, 1979.
All right. Yeah. Wait, a 79 diesel Cutlass.
1979 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme Brougham.
With T-tops.
Diesel.
You know, that's...
It was an old V8 converted into a diesel. Oh, my God. This car had underdrive. It was so slow.
That's awesome.
Big, safe car. Three frames welded together into one monster frame. But then the first car I bought was a Ford F-150 long bed. Love that thing. Straight six.
Right.
With two 19-gallon gas tanks. So it could carry 38 gallons of fine American petrol.
87. No. So, yeah, that's a pretty crazy – well, that's a big truck, for one, and 38 gallons is – quite a lot of money. It's at least $100 at the gas pump, but the 79 Cutlass, that's a classic right there. that's the kind of car that you might, you know, if you were older, you might have driven to the Little House on the Prairie for your day of filming.
That car was the bomb. Absolutely. Fun joy rising here. Very irresponsible. I put unleaded in it and basically blew out the engine. So, yay.
Welcome. Welcome to the mechanic. So you're ongoing. You're pretty much a shark who never stops working. I see that there's a TV series.
I love that description.
Well, I look at actors like that. I mean, as soon as you stop acting, I mean, well, you know, it really is literally in your DNA. Well, it's something I feel as though
so
you need to do.
Fun. It's so fun. So, of course, you pursue that as much as you can.
Yeah.
Always.
So what's next for
and
you?
I'm learning the lesson now. You got to make your own stuff. So
yeah.
You got to get on that.
But what's next for you? Like, what's, do you want to focus on film, TV, both?
Well, I got one. Two, three, theater, film, and TV all working in the works or have been done, shot, ready to come out. Signed an NDA, can't talk about one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one isn't made yet, so I can't talk about that. And
Hollywood!
We did Diary of Anne Frank, Latinx. So we replaced the family with an entire Latinx cast. And I was still the, you know, Dutch guy hiding the family in the attic. Did that for two successful runs in L.A. And then we're going to do some school performances maybe in October and take it to the Chutzpah Festival in Vancouver.
The Chutzpah.
Excited
wow.
for that. And I'll know more about the movie in a little bit. And I'm working on a web series, and the ink is not quite dry in the contract.
Well, this internet thing's, I don't know, it seems to be a fad.
it may be. I don't know. Well, interesting, though, that there is no longer broadcasting. We don't have nights where people sit down and watch Cheers or Cosby Show. You know, 39.5 million people used to sit down and watch these shows every night. We have what's known as narrow casting, and now it's, you know, shows with 1.5 million people can get renewed, and there's shows out there with 800,000 viewers that, although on the bubble, got picked up for another series. So how is this possible? Nielsen ratings were pretty had a lot of obfuscation. You had no idea who was in the room, who filled out the form. Did you lie about it? Were you really watching this when you watched this?
Mm-hmm.
Today, online, Amazon, Netflix, all that, They know who you are. They know your IP address, your social security number, your driver's license number, your last Amazon purchase, your next Amazon purchase, before you know what it is.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
And that value, so what? So 800,000 people watch a show, say, like Silicon Valley. Those 800,000 people live in San Jose and can afford a Peugeot. So the marketing data on those certain people that watch shows hold a much higher ticket value than it used to in the 70s and 80s when TV had a classic commercial kind of supportive structure. And now we're seeing cable shows where people are demanding a theatrical experience, but over 10 hours. Go produce that. I want something like, you know, Game of Thrones or Westworld or, yes, huge but lavish budgets. Please give that to me weekly, please.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the productions are out of control. I feel it's interesting you said that Little House on the Prairie should be made again. I don't know if you could make Little House on the Prairie.
It should be made again Tarantino style with the mud and the cholera and broken ankles by wagon wheels and dead kids. And, like, it should be rough. Oh, my wife is saying dinner time. I'm sorry. As I was saying in the prairie, I think it's time for supper, Pa.
It's like with the overexposed film. I forget what it's called. Like the the kind of weathered film.
Oh, totally. I remember getting the Prairie Challenge where people try to live for 30 days out of the prairie. It was like some reality, show, and it was awesome. I loved it.
You know, I spoke to the author of a particular short book called Slaughterhouse on the Prairie, and it was basically about the Bloody Baiters who lived kind of close to the real Ingalls family. And they were basically some of the first documented serial killers of the 19th century.
Yeah, so they were taking travelers. They had a tarp, basically like a tapestry up in their living room. And you'd come in and the ma would serve you soup. And as you're eating the soup, they would come behind the tapestry and knock you out, take your belongings, bury you in the back. They found like 27 corpses on that property.
Oh, Bloody Baiters, you're at it again.
Right? Is this who you're talking about?
Yes, it's exactly. You did a wonderful explanation of way they would kill them.
H.H. Holmes, all we need is a good Donner Party movie, a good H.H. Holmes movie, mm-hmm. which I think Leo was working on, and the Baiters completely...
And
I
you can have in the background cool. maybe Mary just kind of looking for her glasses or something like that in the log. See, it doesn't look like... No, that couldn't be. But, Keith, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Mark,
tonight.
Awesome. Good to talk to you. Hope we didn't go too off the rails there. I loved the time I spent on the prairie.
I'm glad.